exam, and it will be at 800. It will be in upper auditorium, so we have room to spread out, and I would like to ask you to spread out when you get there. It will cover material through the problem sets and workshops that you're working on this week. Next week, the workshops and labs will go on normally, and since we're sort of right getting started in Newton's Law stuff, what we will be doing in the workshop next week will be more Newton's Law stuff. And so, in fact, working on it is very useful for sort of getting stuff that is going to be on the test to gel, even though you'll be practicing some things that won't be on the test for the workshop next week. So, in other words, I'm sort of moving on in the workshop next week, but it is close enough to what you need to be doing that I actually consider it useful for you, so I'm not at all holding back on that. Labs go on as normal. I will not, however, have a problem set in the next week. That you can concentrate on exam stuff. excuse me. So we'll cover material through chapter 4 in the text. You can bring in an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper with anything that you would like written on it. Helpful points that will calm you down. Formulas, example problems, I don't care. But I will warn you, if you are actually thinking you're doing much in the way of preparing for the exam, fretting about at length what exactly to put on the sheet, you probably need to rethink how you're approaching it. You don't even have that many formulas. And on top of that, I will include with the exam a formula sheet that has anything that I think you sort of need on it there anyway. The nice thing about doing your own is you sort of know exactly where it is, what form it is, and where it came from, so I don't have a problem with that. But just beware that this really doesn't count as studying. Bring a scientific calculator and a pen, do an exam and pen. Any other questions about the exam? No? Okay. So it is a good idea to look at my past exams on the web. Yes. Pen. P-E-N. Yes. I don't know. No, I know. Lots of people hate using pen, and they always say, "You sure? You really mean pen?" Yeah, I really mean pen. I don't want you spending time erasing on this stupid test. We grade by partial credit. You may start off and then decide you're wrong and then go off on some other thing. But if it was right, you'll get partial credit for it, even though you went over here and did wrong stuff. So I actually want to see what you write. If you do think you did something over here that was very different from what you were thinking about over here, circle it or something and draw TA's attention to it. But it's a lot all about partial credit. And that's a two-edged sword, which means if one of you is extraordinarily insightful, and you can look at the problem and you know the answer, you feel it in your bones, and you write it down very neatly and circle it, it is wrong unless you tell me how you got it. Because that's what we're actually interested in, not the final answer in general. That may not be true for all the problems, okay? There may be problems like that are sort of multiple choice-ish, and depending on the form of some of those, I may not want you to defend them, but you may see multiple choice problems, and I actually want you to at least jot down what your logic was so that we know what we're thinking. Because that's what it's all about. Okay, so I do want you to be sure, remember, the TAs are going to be looking at it, and most of your grade comes from what they can infer about what you're thinking about all the crap you write. So, be sort of neat-ish, and by no means you want to be erasing and stuff like that, because the minute you do that, you can't get any credit for it, it's going to be bad. And then there's the usual reason you should use them, so you don't erase it and come in and ask for a regrade. And I'm sure nobody here to do that, but just, you know, there is the usual stuff. So in a sense, using pen is protecting you as well. Yes?
Do you
have
a fraction calculator?
Yes. No, I don't mind. Again, If you come in with a calculator that is so powerful that you can point the camera at the problem and it gives you the final answer and you write it down, doesn't do any good. So you can have a very powerful calculator, and from that you might be able to figure out how to plot something or do a quadratic or whatever. But if you set up a quadratic equation, we have to know you know how to solve. We have to know what you're doing. So you can't let your magical box do it for you. That's not what it's about. Okay? Alright. So if you look at past exams, you may find them to be useful. There is a link on the class website that will take you to a page that has basically all the exams that I think I've given since I've been at Rochester. So that will include that are relevant for you would be Physics 113 and Physics 121 exams. I'm going to go 121. 121 and 113, at least as I teach them, are almost identical. You guys are mature. I push you. The engineers, they're freshmen. They don't even do their homework half of them until they get, you know, they gotta grow up a little bit. So that means that although in principle 121 is supposed to be a little more mathematical, you really can't press it that far. So in fact, I find that largely it's the same class, which I'm only really telling you because it means largely the 121 exams are also reasonable places for you to look for example problems. Now, there is a big caveat, and that is that the courses evolve a little through time, and these go way back. Also, I've tried different things, so certainly there have been incarnations where I listened to a good old friend of mine named Jeff Kempmeyer who very strongly felt that you should have four term exams during a semester and then a final, so that basically you never had a chance to think about anything else. And he would do that with organic. And I tried that once, and it damn near killed all of us. I don't know. I found out I was never doing anything except making out exams. Students felt like they were never doing anything about taking them. The TAs were going to choke me if I gave them one more thing to grade. So I don't do that anymore. But you will find that happened. And the reason that it's relevant is because it totally changes the synchronization of the course. So exam one on a semester like that covers like half of what we're covering. And I don't know, you may find another time where exam one covered a bit more. So you need to be a little careful about looking at it and thinking about, oh, but we haven't covered this. Is this supposed to be on there? You may not have covered it, and it won't be on our test, but it might be on the one I gave in 2003, okay? So just keep that in mind. But otherwise, you know, these are usually pretty good. I will have one version up there most of the time. In some cases, maybe I lost something. But in most cases, I'll have one version, which is a clean copy with no solutions on it, and then there'll be another version of the solution. So you're welcome to look through all of that. Another piece of information is that for my research, I work on a couple of different particle physics experiments, one of which is about 90 miles north of Tokyo. So I have to go to Japan next week. So Tuesday's lecture will go on, but it will not go on here. I will post slides and some sort of audio file. The audio file will be better than the kind you would pick up from the normal lecture because I'll use a mic and I will be careful annotations on the slides. So I don't care if you listen to it or not on Tuesday. You can put it off till after the exam if you want. But I'm coming back the following Tuesday, and when I walk in here, it will be as if we had that lecture. All right, I'm not repeating the lecture. It's just going to happen. I'm going to be starting a new stuff. So just beware. Make yourself comfortable. I'm fine if you want to have a cappuccino or a shot of tequila while you're listening to it. I'm okay with that. That said, one thing that we miss at a time, there are a couple of things that I just want you to be aware of. One is obviously it's hard for me to do demos, although depending on what it is, maybe I point to some Java applet. Two, usually when I'm doing it, I can't do it until after I give the lecture, the last lecture I have here, and sometimes I head right to the airport, which means I actually wait until I'm there, which means I'm giving it to you when I'm jet lagged and in a motel room or something and staring at the wall. So it's really hard for me to make it entertaining because I feel like an idiot sitting there talking to myself. So just, you know, I'm sorry for that. The other thing is it's hard for you to ask questions. Most of you don't ask questions in here anyway. But you can certainly send me an email if you want, and I will try to respond. I should have access to the online part of the book, so in principle I can respond with that too. But I will have the slides, so I can respond with that way. The one issue with this kind of trip is there may be a significant lag, because I'll sleep while you're awake. So you may email me in the middle of the day, but it will be the next day or that night before I actually read it. Okay? You all right with that? All right. I will have TAs proctoring the exam. Be nice to them, or I'll get mean TAs next time. They will be under instructions. I guess I'll go ahead and give you a couple of exam instruction things. I try very hard to write the problems in a clear fashion. That being said, it's very easy to write something that's very clear to me, and only later I realize that it's ambiguous if you're not used to the way you write the problem. So if you are confused about what the problem is asking, if you do not have confidence about what the physical picture is I'm trying to paint in your mind that you are to think about and analyze, you should raise your hand and ask the proctor or me, whoever's there. And their instructions will be to do their best to sort of clarify that, because I'm not intending to test your ability to necessarily interpret English in the way that we write our physics problems. I don't really want that to be the issue. And sometimes it really is. And sometimes I'm not aware of that until the middle of the test when four people have asked the same question and not to think about it. And so under those circumstances, if there's something that needs clarification during the exam, I'll ask the TA to actually explain things during the class. Okay? All right. Anything else about the exam? Okay. So in a sense, we're really getting into it now. A lot of what you'll do for the rest of your time in physics will be based on the kind of stuff that we're learning right now. So classical physics, which is really this physics plus what you'll learn in the first half of Physics 114, is certainly, most of it is based on what this guy did, Isaac Newton, and he really lays out what you need to know in three laws that we started talking about last time. One is that a body persists in a state of motion unless acted on by a net external net force. So there are a couple of tricky words in there. One is external. So I can push on myself and I don't go anywhere. Because although there is a force on this hand, and there is a force on this hand, there is no external net force. So this sort of internal thing just cancels out in a way to think about. Sometimes this can be a little bit subtle, but that's what he means when he says externally. The other is net force, so I can have a big linebacker coming in from this side and one coming in from this side. You know, if they're both just pushing at me, maybe I won't go anywhere if they push with the same force equal and opposite. But the net force on me is zero. So that's really what it means. Persists in a state of motion unless acted on by an external net force. That actually is counterintuitive because it isn't what you run into in life. If you're shoving a car up a hill or downhill or, you know, whatever, and you let go, it doesn't just keep going. It stops, right? If you're moving a box along the floor, it stops. So if I take, I have this chunk of aluminum, And this thing we call a cart, which fits nicely on the aluminum, and I'm going to put it on gently because I don't want to scratch the aluminum. You can't tell, but I'm actually pushing on it right now. It goes nowhere. And the reason it goes nowhere is that there are forces between the two surfaces such that as I push on it, those forces sort of bind, right? It's an electrochemical thing. They bind a little bit so that effectively they give me a force backward that cancels out the one that I'm pushing with. However, if I remove the force between those surfaces by sending air through this aluminum track, which has little holes in it, so it basically turns into a strangely shaped air hockey table, if you want to think of it that way, right? Air hockey table, it's the same sort of thing. You have this little puck, and you put air coming up through little holes, and all of a sudden, it's no longer sliding on the surface, but it's on air, so it moves very nicely. So this is sort of the same thing. And now if I exert a little force on this thing, and I let go, it continues in its state of motion until another force is exerted on it. So I guess Newton had an air hockey table. I don't know. It's actually fairly insightful to well, I guess they did have ice in England in those days, so the same sort of thing. So a body persists in a state of motion unless acted on by an external net force. So that's the first law. The second law is that the sum of the forces, the vectorial sum of the forces, is equal to the mass times the acceleration. So push hard on something, it accelerates. Push hard on something that has twice the mass, accelerates it. After acceleration, if you have the same force, sort of intuitive. So that one I think is fairly intuitive. If I have a linebacker hitting me this way and a linebacker hitting me that way, I go that way. That's my acceleration because it's a vector combination. So it's the net external vector combination that's important. So that is the second law. Then the third law we call the law of action and reaction, which says for every force there is an equal and opposite force. So there is a force of gravity that is on me, drawing me toward the center of the earth. And we quantified that last time. It's mg, actually, in terms of its magnitude. And I should go just falling toward the center of the earth. The reason I don't is because there is an equal and opposite force, which is the force of the floor on my feet pushing back up. And you don't really think of the floor pushing on you, but it is, because you're pushing on it, and you're not going anywhere, so there must be this other force in there. So that would be the reaction force. And sometimes reaction forces, we would actually call that one the normal force, because it's a force that is at normal with respect to how the surfaces interact. You can have normal forces that are in different directions. So right now there's a normal force which is on my hand pointing this way because if it wasn't, I would be falling over on the floor. Okay, so that's a normal force. That's a reaction force. It really is there. I have a powerful cannon here. On wheels. And so what we're going to do I have a pellet of dry ice which I'm going to put in a sealed tube and then I'm going to take this cork and shove it in hard and now we're going to wait. All right, so what did you see? You guys okay over here? Where did it go? I see it. It's right between the two strokes. Uncomfortably far back. Okay, so what you saw was that there was clearly a force on the cork because the cork went flying out that way, right? But did you notice what happened here? It went backwards. So there was a force that was also on this cannon. Okay, the recoil, which is that equal and opposite force. So when you have it set up in a situation where you can, see it, then that law of action and reaction is fairly important. So we're going to do a lot of problems with the blood on myself. Okay, can you hold that? Alright, so we're going to do a lot of problems with ropes and the such here. Okay? And ropes are sort of weird because if I pull on it, I'm exerting a force this way. Okay? What does he feel? You feel a force this way, right? What do I feel? I actually feel a force that way, but you don't think that because I'm pulling. Okay? He's not pulling. He's just holding. You want to think of it that way. But now watch what happens. This is going to be a story. You'll be able to tell your whole life. How was it, your physics professor died? Because it is true, I was not like the skateboard guy. And I'm still not. And I did skiing, not snowboarding. So, okay, or do skiing, not snowboarding. Okay, so now I'm going to pull and look at what happens. You don't pull, you just hold. I pull, and what happens? Right? I go this way. So there is a force on me, even though all we did is hold, and I did the pulling. So you've got this weird sort of thing going on. When I pull this way, there is an equal and opposite force that way on me. Same for him, because he is pulling in the sense that he's holding. And he has that force on him. He's having to exert a force with his hand to keep it from going, right? So in spite of my telling him multiple times not to pull, he was pulling. So thank you for not jerking me. So the other thing to think about is you have this very strange situation in this rope itself, in that it is exerting a force on me, I'm exerting a force on it. If you think of a position right here in the middle of the rope, it is pulling on the piece of rope beside it with that same force. This piece is pulling that way. So there is this sort of internal force in the rope, which we call tension. Okay? And it can be a little bit subtle. And we'll make sure that you do problems that sort of bring that out. But just sort of to show you, that when you're dealing with these rope problems often, this reaction force is a very important thing to consider. Okay? Okay, so maybe that's enough conceptual stuff for the moment. Why don't we I'm going to sort of give you a set of rules for doing problems, and all of which I expect to sort of just flop, you know. Listen to me for a minute, I'll tell you a few things, I'll think I've done something, but you won't actually get it, what I'm talking about, so we'll do some example problems that I want to illustrate. So I call it a path to enlightenment. It's very important to actually slowly and systematically go through these types of problems, because one of the things that you'll find is that your intuition will mislead you in Newton's law of problems. So if you start cutting corners, you will find yourself just getting them flat out wrong. So first of all, you want to read it and sort of understand what the problem is asking, get the picture right in your head. And then you'd like to draw a neat diagram of the overall problem. And I actually mean it's a good idea to draw a fairly neat diagram of the overall problem. Because if you make it too messy, and this force that you draw down is actually at this angle or something, then you can really screw up the whole problem. So you don't want your drawing to be so messy that it actually misleads you. You need to be a little bit careful with that. Then, what happens is, within the problem, which may consist of many different parts, a pulley and three masses and an inclined plane or something, okay, they're all connected by some rope. The system will have some motion, and a way to think about this is that each piece of the system will have motion, which means the acceleration of each part of the system, each mass, for example, has to follow Newton's second law. So the sum of the forces on that particular thing has to be equal to ma on that particular thing. And that will be true for each piece of the problem. And those are sort of independent pieces of the problem. They get married together. For example, this mass and that mass might be connected by a rope or a spring or something like that. So that the mass pushing on one, the force pushing on one this way is the same as the force pushing on the other way. Okay, there may be a connection between them, but those individual pieces have to satisfy Newton's second law in each of three dimensions. So in principle, for each part of the problem, you have three separate equations that you can get with that law. It's usually not that complicated, but you can do that. So you need to write down each part of the problem, each piece that's in there, and then look at the forces that are on that individual mass or pulley or whatever it is that's in there. And we call that drawing the free body diagram of each of these particular things. Okay? And then for each of those bodies, you basically can do Newton's laws and solve then, if you have any equations and unknowns, you can solve for what you want. Each of these bodies, you may need to choose a convenient coordinate system. So imagine if I have a problem where I have a pulley with a rope that holds a mass and a rope that goes around the other side of the pulley that's connected to a mass that slides up and down the inclined plane. The obvious coordinate system for this mass is going to be one which goes up and down. We can call it y if you want, right? So think about it. Here's one body on the inclined plane. Here's the body that's going up and down. When this goes up an inch, this goes this way an inch. It doesn't go down an inch. It goes this way an inch. So the coordinate system that makes sense for the inclined plane is not this, but is that. And in that coordinate system, this one relates very simply to that one. This one goes down an inch, this one goes up the inclined plane an inch. Okay? So, I hope you can sort of see from that quick example that you want to choose this coordinate system for this coordinate system along the inclined plane for that mass, and now we have a simple relationship. Force on this is force up the plane on this one, for example, or the acceleration of this relates simply to the acceleration of that. And so then you can relate the motion of those two pieces. So again, this will all be clear with examples. Now, so you get a lot of these equations and all these accelerations and positions and velocities and stuff. You have to worry about tensions. There are probably two or three of you in this class who are more comfortable with numbers than you are with variables and problems. Break that habit. Many of you may be tempted to put in numbers immediately. It's a huge mistake. If the size is what's going on in the problem, it completely hamstrings you for later on. You want to leave everything to be symbols all the way to the end. Okay? what you're given may dictate a little bit what you're trying to solve for, and you know, you want to think about it, but don't put in numbers until the end. And one of the reasons for this is that in some problems, when you look at what you're supposed to know about this body and that body, you don't have everything. And as you do the mathematics of how these things are related and solve for one variable and from another, what you don't know cancels out. But if you put in numbers, you're done. Things can't cancel. Well, you don't have a number for that one, but you'll run into trouble. There are other reasons why you need to not have numbers, and part of this is when you look at the mathematical form of the final equation, you can often sort of make some sense as to whether the equation makes sense or not by imagining a problem that you just know the answer to. So if I have a body here and a body here with a rope going over a pulley, I can find an equation that relates the acceleration of these two depending on the masses, and we'll do this one shortly. But that's got to be some complex relationship of how massive these two things are. But if this one has a mass of a feather and this one has a mass of a bowling ball, I don't need no equation to tell me what it's going to do, right? It's going to drop at g. So when I can look at my equation, I can sort of say, well, suppose this mass is really small and this mass is really big, what happens? I know what happens. So I can look and see if the equation simplifies to that. We call it a limiting case. If the limiting case makes sense, then I know that I probably have the right form. If the limiting case makes no sense, then I know I'm wrong. And I have to go back and rethink it. So it's a very powerful thing to do. And you can only really do it if you have symbols in your equations at the end. Okay? So that's sort of the recipe. And now what I'd like to do is to just do some examples and get you into the swing of things. All right, so the first example, an air sea rescue. So we've got a dude there who's being pulled up out of the water. In this case, he's already out of the water. And he's got the snapping jaws of a wicked shark right beneath him. And the helicopter is accelerating upward, as you would hope the helicopter would do if you were that guy. In this case, we're going to give actual parameters to the problem. We're going to say the guy being carried by the rope is 70 kilograms in terms of his mass, and that the helicopter is accelerating upward at 4 meters per second squared. And some of you who are particularly on top of things, or anal, or however you want to look at it, might be worried about the mass of the rope. And in the real world, we might worry about the mass of the rope. It is possible I would give you a problem where you have to worry about the mass of the rope at some point. But unless I make it very clear that you need to worry about the mass of the rope, don't worry about the mass of the rope. The mass of the rope is zero for this problem, even though that's not really true in real life. So this is one of those things that sometimes you'll run into, and why I'm telling you to raise your hand in exam problems once in a while. Because in the real world, yeah, the rope has mass. And if you're really thinking about this stuff, yeah, you need to worry about it. But in these problems, we try not to complicate things too much. And if we do, if I'm going to give you a rope with mass, I will tell you this rope has mass and you need to worry about it. Okay? But otherwise, usually you'll see sort of the lawyer's catchwords like the rope is massless, the pulley is massless, da 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 da. Okay? So don't worry about the rope, as I haven't told you. But we do have to worry about the rope because although we're going to call it massless, it's real, and we want to worry about whether or not it breaks. Right? So we want to know what tension must the rope withstand. So I might actually ask it that way. What tension must the rope withstand? And you might think, well, what do I know about the tension? What we know about the tension is the tension represents the force that is in this rope. And as the tension increases, there will come a point where the rope will break. And if the rope breaks, this dude dies. That's the problem. And I don't say it that way, right? I say, what tension must the rope withstand? So you have to sort of infer what it is I'm talking about. So that's a little bit what I mean about read the problem and sort of get a sense that you understand what's being asked. And if you don't, that's when you ask the question. So what tension must the rope withstand? All right, so there's the problem. We'll call that our big picture. So now what I want to do is to look at all the individual little pieces and draw free body diagrams, if you want to think about it that way. One, let's call this the helicopter. For the helicopter, what forces do I have on it?
Very well.
Okay, which would be manifested as the rope pulling down the helicopter. That's how, because we want the guy to be separate. Otherwise, we have sort of an internal system and it doesn't make any sense to us. So, I have a tension in the rope that is down from the helicopter. What other forces might be on the helicopter? Because if this is all we've got, the helicopter's going down.
There it's going up.
Okay, so there must be a force going up. In this case, the propeller's turning, so you've got sort of this force of the air up, which is complicated, okay? Don't let that stop you yet, but it's going to be hard for us to figure out what to do with that. What else?
Gravity.
It has mass. Okay, we don't have a massless helicopter. There'll be a force down, which is due to gravity, which will be mass of the helicopter times G. Alright. So we don't know much about any of that stuff. Don't let that bother you at the moment. What do we know about the man? What are the forces on the man? Okay, the helicopter is pulling him up. It's the other end of the rope, so it will have a force of magnitude T, and actually I wrote T here and I wrote T here. They're different ends of the same rope, so they are the same T. Okay, they are correlated. What else is on the man? Gravity. Mass of the man times G is the force of gravity, in this case down. Okay. I don't know diddly squat about F air or the mass of the helicopter, so at the moment I'm just going to ignore it because I don't even know what to do with it. Let us look at what's going on with the man. What we know about the man is he's holding on this rope. He's got force of gravity down on him, and he's accelerating upward at 4 meters per second. So if we just look at that, let's call this the positive y direction that way, then we know that we have the mass of the man times the acceleration of the man is equal to t minus the mass of the man times g. This would be the sum of the vector forces in the y direction. Right? This is Newton's second law, and here I'm just laying out what the forces are. And you note that I have to be very careful with the algebraic signs. I choose up to be positive. This tension is going up, so it comes in the positive sign. M mass, M times G is going down, negative. So there's Newton's second law. In this particular case, I know now that's sort of the equation. I don't know what else to do at this point. I can write a similar thing here, but I don't have any information about these things. But here, I know that this is 70 kilograms. I know that this is 70 kilograms.
This is 9.8 meters per second squared, and this is given to me in the problem. It's going up at 4 meters per second squared, so this is a plus 4. Now I have everything except the fork, the tension, and the rope, which I can solve for. The tension in the rope is equal to the mass of the man times G plus A. So this is 4 plus 9.8 times 70, which at some point I calculated it as 966 newtons. The N is the symbol for newtons. If I made an algebraic mistake there, sorry. But, okay? So what does that mean? That means the rope, you have the physical situation where he's accelerating upward at 4 meters per second squared. In that case, you know you've just calculated what the tension of the rope is. If the rope cannot withstand that much tension, you cannot accelerate just without breaking the rope. Right? The rope could withstand more, potentially. That wasn't really what we asked. We just asked, how much must it withstand if this is not going to kill the body? Okay? Any questions on that? Yes.
So what confuses me is that the man is pulling down the rope with the force of tension that the helicopter is pulling up. So why doesn't the rope have to stay close to that? Because it's getting pulled to go down.
So the question was, if the man is pulling down with 966 newtons, which we know to be true, or we just calculated it, and the helicopter is pulling up with 966 newtons, why is the tension not twice as much on the rope? And I have to tell you, that's a fabulous question, and it gives me an opportunity to talk about something. Consider two ropes. Let us suppose that we have a mass M here, a mass M here, and a mass M here. Don't worry about the mass of the rope. This rope is going around a pulley that is massless and frictionless. Another pulley, massless and frictionless. And then we have this one where we have the going around a massless and frictionless pulley, and it's tied to a wall. How many of you think this rope will break first? Or break? What, no, let me rephrase that. In which rope is the tension greater? This one? Raise your hand if you think it's greater than that one. This one? That's not very good at raising your hand. You think it's the same? Alright, so I really couldn't tell much. I saw a few of these. This gets at her question. Is the tension twice as much here because I'm pulling this way and that way? Whereas this one, you're sort of just pulling that way. So, right. Sort of soft. Here, what do I know? I know that I have mg down and I have a tension up. I know that I have a tension this way because the rope is being pulled with that.
and the wall has to pull back with the same tension. Okay? But it's all the same value. Here, I have mg down, I have a tension up, and I know that I have that tension up, and I have mg down. These values are the same. In the case of this, the wall literally is having to pull. The reaction force is mg into the wall. Otherwise, the rope goes somewhere. So, the wall is doing exactly what this mass is doing, which is it's pulling with mg that way. But it's just one mg. This doesn't mean I get 2 mg in the rope. Ropes are a little subtle that way. I mean, I don't know. You'll get used to it. I'm not sure if I can say anything to make it warmer and fuzzier for you if it's not clicking right now. Feel free to ask if there's something. Do you see? I've given this problem on exam and half the class missed it, so I mean, I know this is subtle. In fact, it's on your workshop for next week, except I had to shorten the workshop because I wanted to get some more material, and so I threw this problem out. So you may see it the following week and discuss the workshop. So the answer is that the man pulling on the rope gets transferred to the helicopter. The helicopter pulling on the rope gets transferred to the man. But it's not really as if you have twice the force. It's sort of the same force that's all along the road. Okay, I don't know where else to go with that. Feel free to ask questions. But let me do another demo that I think might be fun. Can I have 2 volunteers? Hi, you are? Mylock. Okay. And you are?
Cole.
Mylock and Cole. All right. So what we have here are 2, just feel, hold it. Okay, so these are fairly heavy balls, okay? So now let them down gently. And what we're going to do is to ask Lila to be right here to yank. Okay? Very fast, quick yank. I'm going to ask Cole to very slowly increase the tension in the spring and pull slowly, slowly, slowly until the spring breaks. Okay? And now, don't do it yet. I want them to think about what's going to happen first. All right. So, a 50% chance, right? Swap places. So Lilac is going to yank, and Cole is going to pull slow. Okay? Now, there are 4 possibilities up here, which I want to point out to you, and I want you to consider. In A, Cole's string breaks here, and Lilac's string breaks here. In B, both strings break up there. In C, Cole's string breaks here, Lilac's here. And in D, they both break down here. Think for a moment. Which one you think it is. Fix the letter in your mind. Close your eyes. All of those who think it's A, raise your hand. B.
See? D? Okay, so if you want to look and see what the numbers, how they broke down, and again, I'm not much with unitarity, so this doesn't add up to the number of people in the room, but this is a rough, gives you an idea of the scale. Most of the people thought it would be B, a few people said this, a few people said that, and a number said this. Okay, so go for it. So why don't, let them know separately, so Lila, you go first. That's okay. No, hold on. Go ahead and hold it here, and you just want to yank. Okay, Lilac, you fail physics. All right, Paul, you go for it. And then we'll talk about what Lilac did wrong. Okay, so what both of you did is, in fact, this one, which most of you said. So, thank you. And we'll talk about it. Sometimes it doesn't actually work because, in fact, that's wrong. Yeah. You know, it's the real world, and my guess is we have an imperfection in the screen there for Lilac up on top. And normally it works. It's not trivial. I mean, I have to tie strings or I'll just redo it a couple of times. But generally what will happen and what I would want for you to answer on the test would be this one. Okay? Tell me why. If I'm pulling slowly, I'm pulling down with the tension. That pulls down on the ball with the tension, same tension, which means it's slow. There's no acceleration, which means the ball has to have that same tension pulling up, which means I have to have the same tension pulling down, except here's T. I also have for this ball the mass of the ball times G, and these are sort of heavy balls, which means this tension has to be T plus mg, otherwise it accelerates. So tension plus mg up here, which means this rope has a bigger tension in it than the one beneath. That's where it will break. If you yank it fast, now you put a huge force down below, a big T prime or something, and it will eventually transfer up to the rope up above, but remember that what happens is you have this thing is undergoing an acceleration. And it has a big mass. So there is a momentary lag time, if you will, called inertia. I mean, basically you call the inertia the same before it begins to move. And until it begins to move slightly, it can't extend the rope up above and give it its full tension. So if you pull it really fast, in a sense, you get the tension in the rope down beneath much larger than you get the tension up above in that instant. And the one underneath will break. Unless you're liable. Okay, but most of the time it works. So that would be the correct answer. Okay? I warned you, Newton's laws are subtle. And you may imagine that, you know, the stuff we've done up until now really hasn't been very subtle. And that's sort of the reason why I'm pushing to get a little bit of this on the first exam. Because I don't want the first exam to have no subtleties in it. Because then some of you are copying and stop studying. And then I kill you on the next exam. And that's totally happened, which is why I'm pushing a little bit right now. That's from experience. All right. Another example. Say that I have a massless and frictionless pulley. And this pulley has a rope that goes over it. And on this rope, we have two masses hanging, M1 and M2. And we'll say that the system is at rest. Then released. What is the acceleration or motion of the system? Okay, so this might be a little bit funny
in terms of how you think about it, because you might argue the system isn't moving anywhere. The pulley is nailed to the wall, so it's just going to rotate. But what I mean by this phrasing is that depending on the relative size of these masses, they're going to do this, so they're going to do that, right? So that's really what we mean. And we have to choose coordinate system if we're going to figure out what's going on here. And this is one of the first ones where something gets a little bit strange. It is natural for many beginners to look at this and go, well, I'll call it up positive for both. But I want you to think about it for a moment. If this mass goes down, this mass goes up. So if I want to call this a positive acceleration, I'd like this to be a positive acceleration. So that when I have an equation here and an equation here, they mean the same thing. You can do this problem such that you call this up for this mass and this up for that mass. But now think about it. When this one goes down and has a positive acceleration, well, in this case, I said up for both, this one would have a negative acceleration, then this one will be positive. Which means when I want to relate the equations I have for this body to the equation for that body, I have to flip the sign every time properly. So that's really hard to do and keep track of. So what you want to do is to think about the whole motion of the system. And in this case, you want to define the coordinate system such that one of the directions of rotation of the pulley is positive. So I'm going to call this positive, which means here, positive is down, and here, positive is up. Just for completeness, so that it makes sense if you read it in a book, don't know why, but we call this an Atwood's machine. And I want to actually calculate something, so let's call M1 is equal to 6 kilograms and M2 is equal to 10 kilograms. So you have some sense of what's going to happen, right? If this is heavier than that, it's going to do this. But when I ask what is the acceleration of the system, I want to know what is the acceleration of each of these masses. So another piece about ropes that you want to consider, although in the real life you have this craziness where maybe you need to worry about the rope not really feeling the tension until you actually stretch it a tiny bit or something, in these problems, our ropes are, they don't stretch. So you don't need to worry about, if this goes up an inch, that one goes down an inch. All right, that if you start fretting over the relative stretching of the rope or something, you're going to get all twisted up. So don't make complications. So we're going to assume that these things are easily related to each other that way. And now we want to do free body diagrams for each of these things. Sort of like the helicopter, I can look at the free body diagram for the pulley, and what I know is that I have
have a tension in the pulley down on one that is the same as that's pulling up on one of the masses. I have another tension. These are the same tensions because the tension in the rope is the same everywhere. And then I have to have some force of the wall that's holding the pulley up. I don't know anything about the force of the wall. So this is... I don't know what to do with it, so I'm not worrying about that one. But let's look at the two masses where hopefully we can make some sense out of it. We have mass 1 on the left. So here's mass 1. And we'll say that the rope is pulling up with a tension T. The force of gravity is pulling down, which is M1 times G. The other mass is M2. The rope is just one rope. If the pulley has no mass or friction, the tension in the rope is everywhere the same, which means if I have a tension pulling up on the left-hand side, I have the same tension pulling up on the right-hand side. So here's a T. And FG here is equal to M2 times G down. So those are my free body diagrams. You might say, why don't I worry about anything that's horizontal or in and out of the plane? And in fact, you sort of do, because Newton's law is a vectorial sum, and the vector F is equal to M times the vector A is really a three-dimensional equation, so this is true in each of the three dimensions. Here I don't worry about it because this particular dimension is the one where the motion is going to be in this problem. And you don't know anything about this way or that way. There's nothing that's better than the problem, so it's just sort of adding complications. Don't worry about it. So it's just, it doesn't mean it's not relevant or true, but it's really not relevant for this problem. So don't worry about it. So we only need to worry about the sum of the forces. Net forces on the body is equal to the sum of the forces in the Y, in this case, is equal to M times A in the Y, which is going to be equal to T minus M1G. Why do I choose the signs this way? I choose the signs that way because I'm choosing this as a positive direction. And the tension on the left-hand side is going up in the positive direction, and M1G is down. So that dictates my signs for the left-hand mass. So the tension will be positive, and then M1G will be negative in that case. If you go to the other side, the sum of the forces in the Y is equal to, this is also M1AY. So this is equal to M2 times AY. This is AY1. This is AY2. So this is mass times the acceleration of mass 2 in the Y direction. In this case, positive is down. So M2G comes in with a positive sign, and the T comes in with a negative sign. And because the rope doesn't stretch, if this goes down an inch, this goes up an inch. If this goes down an inch in a second, this goes up an inch in a second. If this goes down an inch per second squared, this one goes up an inch per second squared. It's a one-to-one correlation there, which means the acceleration of this one upward is the same as the acceleration of that one downward, or both upward in the case of how we're trying to do this problem. So that means that this and this are equal. They're the same thing. Okay? So now I have sort of a system of equations of M1 times A. I'll just call it A. This is just equal to A. It's equal to T minus M1G, and I have M2 times A is equal to M2 times G minus T. And now you'll note that I don't know the tension, and I don't know the acceleration, but I have two equations. So if you have n equations and n unknowns, you can algebraically solve. So we can rearrange things and solve for them. So, for example, let's see how far I want to get here. I can say that T is equal to M1 times A minus G, just rearranging this one. And then I can substitute that in over on the other side, so I have M2 times A minus G, so I'll pull this one over, and I'll take this and substitute it in for T. So that's equal to minus T, so that will be minus M1 times A minus G, if you will.
For number one, we do A plus G.
Yeah, thanks. Probably save this from some embarrassment in a moment. Alright, so this is M2 times A minus M2 times G is equal to minus M1 times A minus M1 times G. I can pull the A's together, so I have A times M2 plus M1 is equal to G times M2 minus M1, if I did it correctly, which allows me to solve for the acceleration as G times M2 minus M1 over M2 plus M1. That would be the acceleration. And just as a reminder, I'm going to take this picture and rewrite it. Put it here. Let me go ahead and get the tension. So when I algebraically solve for the tension, so I take this A and I plug it in right here, and then I algebraically clean it up a little. And when you do that, you get T is equal to 2 times G times M1 times M2 over M1 plus M2. And then you circle on and you say, now I know I'm right because Professor Manley said I'm right. Now how do you know you're right? What can you possibly check before you put in numbers? That's an acceleration. What should its units be? What are all its units? The units of this little combination is kilograms. The units of that combination is kilograms. Those cancel. The units of this, meters per second squared, but that's the units of OG, it's an acceleration. So, check. You have the units correct. The other side, this is a force. Force is equal to ma. Force goes kilogram meters per second squared. Meters per second squared, kilograms, kilograms, one of those cancels, that one doesn't. So you have kilograms times meters per second squared. The units of this side are equal to the units of the force. So you should always, 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 always check your units. Why? Why wouldn't you? It's the best and simplest and easiest way to know that you're possibly right.
You can get right and something wrong, but of course, if you get the wrong units here, you know you screwed up something. Usually a sign, and you go back and you find the sign. So always check that. What else can you check? Just look and see if it makes any sense. Limiting cases. If this mass is huge and this mass is tiny, I know that it's going to drop with a positive acceleration of d, because this mass is irrelevant. So does that make sense? If this mass is huge, this is equal to g times m2 because m1 is irrelevant. This is equal to just m2 because m1 is irrelevant. The m2 over here and the m2 over there cancel out. It's a positive sign. A is equal to g. Yes? Okay. So this is a force. F equals ma. So if you want to think about the units of a force, ma kilograms meters per second squared. So that is always the units of a force. If you look on the right-hand side, what we have is kilograms times kilograms over a single kilogram. Here they're multiplied, here they're added. So this just comes in a kilogram, that's twice. So this combination right here represents just kilograms. G is an acceleration, meters per second squared. So kilograms and meters per second squared. You have units of the force here, and units of the force there, so you know you're good. If mass 1 is much bigger than mass 2, then this is what's important. This is what's important. It comes in with a negative sign. You have the thing accelerating g, but it's the other way. So it just makes sense in the limiting cases. So once in a while, the limiting cases are not quite as trivial. Sometimes, you know, to take the limit, you have to actually use L'Hopital's rule. But yeah?
How do you derive the tension equation?
I take this acceleration in this form, and I plug it in right here, and then I do a little bit out,
which I didn't bother doing for you. Okay? All right. One last thing. One more volunteer. Not loud. You are?
I'm Jesse.
Jesse? Okay, Jesse. Come here, Jesse. Stand right here. There's your hand. This is my hand. This is a lead brick on top of my hand. All right? Jesse, I would like you to hit the brick with your hand. But I want you to bear in mind that I do have some bearing on whether or not you will ever go to school. Come on, this is a total chance. Just don't miss and hit my finger. Care for so long as you have good aim. piece of plywood, I wouldn't ask him to do it. So it is true that all of the force is exerted on a small area with just the hammer head, and with this brick, it's spread out, and yes, that makes a difference. But if it were just a piece of plywood, stiff plywood, I wouldn't let him do it. Okay? Because it's still going to hurt like crazy. Same thing as what we had earlier. This is really, really, really massive. I hit it with a big force. It doesn't accelerate very much. It can barely move, right? Because it's so massive. So it takes a huge force. And basically, unless it accelerates, I don't really have much to stop with my hand. So it's just not very exciting. Okay, thanks, Jesse. You should have gone.
Problem set.